Welcome to the Flatbridge Ed podcast series. Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today we're going to do a case study. We're going to continue that same theme that we've been doing over the last few months. And then after this podcast, we're going to continue and we're going to branch off from this podcast. And we're going to do a podcast on balloon pump therapy. And we're going to do another podcast on LVADs. So we'll be kind of looking for that in the next month and a half. Today, though, we're going to do a specific case study called the Nightmare Patient, and it's a balloon pump patient that's got multiple things going on, and at the end, he goes into cardiac arrest. So we're going to talk about all the aspects of this presentation. We're going to look at the different medications he's on. We're going to look at the therapy as far as balloon pump therapy. And I'm not going to go into depth on every aspect of this, but I'm just going to hit on these different things. I think the caregivers for this specific case did a really good job with a very complex patient, and so kudos to them. But I think that this is a patient that we could all have, and could be very overwhelming. So I thought it'd be fitting that we evaluate this and talk about it. So this patient is a patient that's got extensive medical history, has a lot of things going on, everything from right-sided failure to left-sided failure. He's had multiple stents, he's had CABG, hypertension, long history of smoking. He's got chronic renal failure, so he's got a lot of problems. He's 140 kilos. We need to understand that that is obviously a weight that's not matching his height. He's only 70 inches, so he's about 5'10". So we need to always be looking at that based on ventilator management, right? We don't ever want to go off the patient's true weight. We want to go off their height and ideal body weight to determine their total volume. So that's something we need to always remember. And I know a lot of you have listened to the ventilator podcast, and you're aware of that, that we need to always go lower total volumes. So this patient was being transferred for multi-organ failure, sepsis, associated sepsis, and cardiogenic shock. So he had multiple issues going on. He presented into the ED with shortness of breath and chest pain. He was found to be extremely fluid overloaded. He was non-compliant with his meds, and he had an associated right-sided pneumonia with a temperature of 102. They immediately put him in the ICU, and while he was in the ICU, I believe he went into a second-degree type 2 heart block, became very bradycardic in the high 20s, low 30s. He was given one dose of 0.5 of atropine in an attempt to raise that rate, and they decided to put in an internal pacer. They also started him on two different vasopressors, so we'll talk about that. They started trying to offload some of that fluid. They did give him Lasix, which really didn't work, and then they tried to dialyze him as well. Remember, he's in chronic renal failure all the time. They did a 12 lead. They found that he had some elevation. They took him to the cath lab. They found that he had a high LAD occlusion of 80%, and he had 100% occlusion of that circumflex branch. So most likely on the 12 lead, he probably presented with an anterior lateral MI. If you remember our podcast on 12 lead interpretation, you know, a high LAD, you're going to have that anterior involvement, and then that circumflex branch supplies that lateral wall. During the cath procedure, he decompensated. They initiated a balloon pump therapy, and they decided to transfer this patient to a higher level facility. Okay, so like I said, there's a lot of things going on. Number one, this patient's intubated. He's septic. He's got an associated bacterial pneumonia. They're treating him with three different antibiotics, vancomycin, gentamicin, and Levaquin. They've got an internal pacer, so that adds to it. They've got a balloon pump placed. There was a Swan placed in the right IJ via cortis, and I'll give you the hemodynamic parameters here in a little bit. So if you're going into a patient like this, this can be extremely overwhelming if you've never managed a patient with all this going on. Number one, he's intubated, so you're going to have to deal with his sedation and pain management. He's on a ventilator, so that's a big aspect. A lot of people are nervous about ventilator management, and we have to constantly practice that and realize that that's a big aspect of just, you know, patient care is managing that ventilator with this tough patient. you add on that he has an internal pacer that you're going to have to manage now. He's got a balloon pump you're going to have to manage now. He's on two different pressors. He's on neosinephrine and levofed. And you have a patient that's very, very fragile and sick. Remember, any time you move a septic patient like that, you know, they have a release of endotoxins, and they can decompensate very, very quickly. They become peripherally, they vasodilate, and their blood pressure often drops, and, you know, they don't have the cardiac output to sufficiently oxygenate their coronary arteries and their tissues and their organs. He's already in organ failure at this point. He does have that balloon pump, like we said. We'll talk about that here in a second. So when the flight crew arrived, they found the patient to be on a tidal volume of 500. He's on a rate of 20. He's at a FiO2 of 100%, and he's on assist control. So I'm not really going to fault those settings. I think those settings are appropriate for this patient. I think the tidal volume is low. It matches the height, and the respiratory rate is higher. So remember, we want a low tidal volume. We want to decrease the incidence of ventilator lung injury. We want to decrease the incidence of any free radicals, anything being released based on these high tidal volumes, high stretch of those alveoli. And so we also need to, because of that, maintain a minute ventilation that's going to be adequate enough. So that's going to be a higher rate. And historically, what we used to do, we went a higher tidal volume and a low rate. So we have to, if we're going low tidal volume, we've got to make sure that rate is high. And a respiratory rate of 18 to 20 is absolutely appropriate. The other aspect to realize here is this patient was very acidotic with a pH of about 7.1. So a 7.1 pH, patient has a bicarb of 15 and a CO2 of 20, that's telling you that he is over-breathing that vent, he's compensating, and so setting a ventilation rate of 20 and maintaining a sedation that allows him to over-breathe that to kind of protect that pH is very, very important. So again, looking at the big picture, understanding that if we paralyze this patient and we drop his respiratory drive down where he was maybe breathing with the ventilator and his intrinsic rate in the maybe mid-30s, and we drop that rate down into the 20s, low 20s or high teens, you're going to have a precipitous drop in pH. Remember, your ratio or your relation between your pH and your CO2, for every increase or decrease of CO2 by 10 points, you're going to have a reciprocal drop or rise in your pH by 0.08. So to give you an example, if his CO2 was 20 and you dropped his rate down and his CO2 went from 20 to 30, his pH is going to drop by 0.08. So if it was 7.1, it's now going to be right around 7.02, so right around that 7-point line. And every 10 point that you allow that CO2 to raise up, your pH is going to drop again by 0.08. And so pretty soon you're going to have a pH in the, you know, 6.7, 6.8, 6.9 range. He's already extremely sick, extremely fragile. He's not going to be able to handle that. Okay, so enough on the ventilator aspect. So the patient has a temp of 102. And so the flight crew at this point make sure that the transvenous pacer is set appropriately. They switch him over to their transvenous pacer. They set a rate of 80. They get capture with milliamps of 35. Everything is working appropriately there. So they've got a good paced rhythm at a rate of 80. So it's really important now that we're transitioning into the balloon pump that we know that we have a good rhythm with good R waves, because we know that our primary trigger is going to be our EKG with our backup trigger being our ART line. Okay, so now we need to look at our balloon pump. So we need to set up our balloon pump, and we'll talk about that. We need to make sure that we have a good pressure bag set up. We need to make sure that's all set up. Oftentimes when you're transferring a patient like this, they already have a pressure bag set up appropriately. It's already transduced, so you can just unhook that from the patient and hook our line back in down by the transducer, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's the quickest way to do that. Timing, we're going to use a 1-to-1 right? We're going to do one-to-one on this patient. That's full therapy. You can start with a one-to-two to make sure your timing is appropriate, but one-to-one is going to be your primary frequency. We're going to go full augmentation. Remember, augmentation is just how much that balloon is inflating. We want that balloon in full therapy to inflate fully. And then we want our timing to be automatic. Our timing on the balloon pumps now, we don't have to time it on our own. The balloon pump will time it perfectly without us having to manipulate the timing. And then that's how we're going to set that up. We're going to make sure that everything is appropriate, that we have a good site. So this the balloon was inserted in the left femoral artery, so we need to make sure that site is clean, it's appropriate, it's dressed, there's no bleeding or anything like that. So why is this patient on a balloon pump? Well, remember, the whole preface of a balloon pump is you're trying to decrease afterload by increasing diastolic augmentation. So you're trying to improve coronary artery circulation during diastole by also decreasing afterload. So you're decreasing the workload of the heart, but actually perfusing the coronary arteries more efficiently. That's the whole thing about a balloon pump, is reducing the workload, but also perfusing much more efficiently. So they set up the balloon pump. They checked everything, made sure that their augmentation was appropriate, their timing was on their EKG, everything was good. And two things you always want to look at. If you have the ability to look at an chest x-ray, you're going to want to make sure that you see that that tip of that balloon is no further past that second intercostal space, because that's telling you that that is below that subclavian artery that's coming off of the aortic arch. Okay, so two areas, you want that balloon sitting 1 to 2 centimeters below the subclavian artery and 1 to 2 centimeters above the renal arteries. That's where that balloon is sitting in that aortic root. If it migrates up, you're going to lose left radial pulses. So that's something that this crew constantly assessed, and we need to reassess every single, I'd say 5 to 10 minutes. I mean, just be safe and be making sure that that balloon hasn't migrated up and occluded that subclavian artery where you would lose that left radial pulse. The other thing that you have to have with any balloon pump patient is a Foley catheter in place, because we need to monitor urine output. Remember, any patient with good urine output is telling you that they're perfusing in some capacity. Obviously, this patient is in chronic renal failure. He's probably not peeing much normally, so that's going to be a little bit more difficult to assess. In this patient, though, we want to also manage and watch that urine output. If you lose urine output, what that's telling you is the balloon has actually migrated down and occluded the actual renal arteries, and you have renal perfusion that's decreased or cut off completely. Obviously, that's a bad thing. So those are the two things that we're constantly monitoring on a balloon pump patient, is the left radial pulse and the urine output on this patient. That's telling you that that balloon has not migrated. The other thing we always want to look at is we want to be looking at your different pressures. And so it's important to understand unassisted systolic pressure that's probably, let's just for purposes of this, say it's 110. And we want our assisted systolic pressure, so when that balloon is actually inflating and deflating, we want that assisted systolic pressure to be lower than the unassisted systolic pressure. What that's telling you is it's reducing the workload of the heart. Afterload is actually reduced. We also want a reduction in diastolic pressure. So without the balloon being inflated, we want a diastolic pressure, let's say, of 80, just for purposes of me explaining this, and then with that balloon being inflated and it actually augmenting diastole, we want that pressure to be lower. We want a lower diastolic pressure. But because that balloon is doing all the work for the heart, your coronary arteries are perfused much, much better. So we're trying to have a change in both of those pressures, and you're constantly evaluating those pressures and trending those after every single balloon pump cycle. Now, for this purposes of this case study, I'm not going to go into timing All I'm going to say is that you need to be watching the timing and make sure that you don't have any major timing errors, with late deflation being the worst one. And if you've taken an FPC exam or CFR an exam, that's always a standard question. Late deflation is very, very bad. So imagine during the start of the systolic phase, that balloon being inflated still, and it shouldn't be. Remember, that balloon is going to inflate and deflate based on the aortic valve closure. And so when that aortic valve closes, that's indicative of the dicrotic notch on the waveform, then that balloon actually will inflate and deflate. And that's going to be an indication of the end of that cardiac cycle. And so it's going to inflate, and then when that cardiac cycle starts again, it's going to deflate, the systolic phase starts, and it completely does it again. You know, the whole phase starts again. So that timing has to be very, very perfect. The worst, again, is late deflation. We don't want that. That's kind of hindering the whole purpose of the balloon pump. Okay. So I said that this patient had a Swan. There was a Swan placed via a cordis in the IJ, I believe the right IJ. And so remember, a Swan, nowadays, you're not seeing a lot of them. It's kind of a lost art. You're only seeing them on very, very sick patients. There's a high incidence of infection with these you know, indwelling catheters like this, but they can give you a lot of information. And again, I'm not going to go into the whole aspect of advanced hemodynamics. We're going to do a podcast specifically on that. But you can look at specific numbers on this Swan and transduce this and kind of give you an idea what's going on. So classic cardiogenic shock for a patient like this with this presentation, we have to think about how this all plays. And everything kind of flows downstream. And the first thing you're going to look at is you're going to look at the CVP pressure. CVP pressure is basically elementary words is telling you fluid balance. Is this patient dry or are they overloaded? That's the easiest way to think of a CVP pressure. If I had any pressure on a Swan, a CVP, a PA, a wedge, any pressure at all, a CVP is going to be the one that I would want to look at the most if I had to pick between all of them. The next pressure we're going to look at is we're going to look at the PA pressure. So that's pulmonary artery pressure. The whole purpose of that pulmonary artery is to maintain diastole or diastolic pressure. If you think about a MAP pressure, two-thirds of the MAP pressure is the diastolic aspect. And so diastole is very, very important. And we're going to talk about that here further in this case study about a medication that may optimize diastole even more and help kind of augment what the balloon pump is also doing. Okay, then the last pressure you're going to look at is a wedge pressure. And a wedge pressure is basically looking at left ventricular end diastolic pressure. So it's telling you what's going on that left side of the heart. It's also kind of, you could also think about it as a direct indication of left atrial pressure. And so if the CVP is an indication of right venous pressure or right atrial pressure, I should say, that's telling you preload. If the wedge pressure is looking at left atrial pressure, that's preload to the left side. So if that pressure is high, if a wedge pressure, normal wedge pressure is 8 to 12, if that wedge pressure is 18, that's telling you that there's too much pressure going on that left side of the heart. So this patient's presentation had a CVP of 18, had a PA of 40 and 25, and had a wedge of 18. And so that should all tell you that there's an overload aspect on that left side of the heart. And also this patient's cardiac output, cardiac index, was very low. So that's telling you that kind of matches. All right, so a high CVP, a high PA pressure, a high wedge with a low cardiac output is diagnostic for cardiogenic shock or left ventricular failure of some sort. Okay, we've talked about the internal pacer. We've talked about the balloon pump. We're managing both of those. We have the patient on the ventilator, and we need to switch the patient over to our ventilator. So the flight crew in this presentation decided to go with a pressure control mode. They looked at this patient. They checked the plateau pressure, and the plateau pressure was 35. So they opted to go straight to pressure control, and I believe they went SIMV. Remember, I'm a big advocate of SIMV, and I think around the country, a lot of the level 1 ICUs are starting to go with SIMV over assist control. They've identified that patients' lungs atrophy very, very quickly. They start atrophying within 12 to 24 hours. So having a patient on SIMV, along with this patient already in metabolic acidosis that has an intrinsic rate above the ventilator, SIMV is going to be very appropriate. They can overbreathe the vent. It's going to be very comfortable for them. They can synchronize it with the ventilator. You can augment those spontaneous breaths with pressure support, which helps those respiratory muscles fire and just helps the patient not become dependent on the ventilator. Okay, so they opted to go with pressure control. They started with an inspiratory pressure of 26. So we start with an inspiratory pressure on pressure control. We match the PIP, the peak inspiratory pressure, and the PEEP that the patient's on, and we bring those two together for our starting pressure, and then we can dial that down. Remember, in pressure control ventilation, what we're doing is we're setting a pressure. That pressure, when the ventilator fires, it inflates the lung to that pressure and stops and terminates. Based on that lung compliance and the characteristics of that patient, the volume is going to be dependent on those characteristics. So a pressure of 25 for me may give me a tidal volume of 400, and for you it may give you a tidal volume of 450. Everybody is a little different, and those tidal volumes will vary breath to breath. But it's a very, very delicate way to ventilate a lung. And this patient is already septic, has a right-sided pneumonia, has a history of heart disease and a CHF, cardiogenic shock. So this patient's already very, very sick, probably has some lung problems, lung aspects. So ventilating them on pressure control is a safe way. It allows, just a lower volume. It's more gentle. And you already had a plateau pressure that was above 30, and we know that a plateau pressure above 30 is kind of detrimental to our patients. So they immediately went to pressure control. So I applaud them on that. Okay, so when they made patient contact, their initial vital signs, they had a heart rate, a pace rate of 80. They had a blood pressure of 101 over 40. They had a MAP of 60. They had a saturation of 94% and an end-tidal CO2 of 21, okay, with a respiratory effort of 36. So the patient was definitely breathing over the ventilator, which is absolutely appropriate, absolutely fine. They opted to go with an ID ratio of 1 to 2 on their initial ventilator settings, and they went with a respiratory rate of 20 starting out, and then they increased that to 26 to try to maintain, based on their sedation, they wanted to continue with a rate that was going to protect that pH. So in this situation, remember, we have to make sure that if there's any PEEP on this patient already has problems with a VQ mismatch, ventilator perfusion mismatch based on the pneumonia, probably has PEEP applied. So this patient had 5 of PEEP applied. But if this patient were to have 10 of PEEP or 15 of PEEP, when we switch this patient over from the hospital ventilator to our ventilator, it's very, very important to maintain that recruitment, because what will happen is they've probably worked very, very hard to maintain oxygenation based on the PEEP and the FiO2. If you were to take the ventilator off and not take some safety measures, what you're going to do is you're going to lose all that recruitment. So the way to do that is you wait for the patient to take a breath on the hospital ventilator. You get some gauze, you take a hemostat, and at the peak of inspiration, you're going to clamp that ET tube. Once that ET tube is clamped, you can then take the ventilator off, the hospital ventilator off, and then you're going to have your ventilator already set up and ready with the same PEEP. You're going to match that same PEEP, and you're going to put your ventilator back on, and then you can clamp that ET tube. By doing that, you're maintaining the recruitment in the chest. Because you clamp the tube at the peak of inspiration, all that recruitment, because recruitment happens during inspiration, is maintained, and we don't lose that. So that's a very, very important aspect to remember when you're moving a patient over that has a shunt or a VQ mismatch. They've applied some PEEP to maintain saturations. If you don't do that, what you're going to do is you're going to be fighting that O2 sat. You're going to have a patient that's going to have a precipitous drop, and they may arrest. So that's a big deal to remember. Okay, so we have our internal pacer working fine. Our balloon pump is working fine. So let's talk about your difference between your SWAN. So we have a SWAN in the IJ, so we're transducing that, right? And we have to make sure that our transducer is in the phlebostatic axis. Our phlebostatic axis is a direct plane that looks straight through the right atrium and the left atrium, and it's looking straight through there. So every time that we move our patient, we move our patient over from the hospital bed to the gurney, from the gurney into the ambulance, you know, continuing. Every time you change in altitude, because it's based on barometric pressure, we have to re-zero the monitor and make sure that we get a good waveform, a good arterial waveform. So your SWAN and your balloon pump are looking at two different things. They're both going to give you a PA waveform, but they're looking at two separate things. So your SWAN, because that SWAN is floated through the right atrium, through the right ventricle, it sits in that pulmonary artery. That's where it's sitting, okay? It's looking at pulmonic valve closure. So when you have the dicrotic notch and you're looking at that PA waveform, the dicrotic notch is basically looking at pulmonic valve closure. That's an indication of pulmonic valve closure. On your balloon pump is looking at a completely different valve. Since your balloon pump is actually going up through your femoral artery and it's looking and it's going up into your aortic root, it actually is looking, the very tip of that balloon pump is your art line. So it's actually looking at aortic valve closure. So if you ever have a test and it's asking you which valve it's looking at, be very, very cognizant of what the information is telling you. Is it a SWAN that's being placed in the subclavian or the IJ, or is it a balloon pump art line that's actually looking up at the aortic valve? So it's very two different complete valves, and we have to remember that. Okay, so they transfer this patient to the helicopter, they lift, and as they're flying along, they start looking at the pressors. And we haven't really talked about the pressors. So this patient is on neosinephrine and levofed. The neosinephrine dose is 60 mics a minute, which is appropriate. A normal starting dose is 40 mics up to 180 mics. Usually give a loading dose first. So this is kind of a lower dose, and we'll talk about each one of these medications. And then their levofed dose, I believe, was 4 mics a minute. Okay, so let's talk about each one of these medications. And why wouldn't you go with another pressor? You know, historically, especially EMS-wise, we always went dopamine. And I've done podcasts on pressors, and I think, we're getting away with using dopamine. Now, this patient, because the patient's already bradycardic, dopamine may not be a bad option, just maybe as an augmentation to the pressors that they're already on, because it's going to have some chronotropic effects. It's going to increase that heart rate and help that. Now, for this patient, though, he's on an internal pacer, so we really don't have to worry about that. So let's look at each medication and the differences. When we look at neosinephrine is a potent alpha stimulator, all right? The thing that it does, it has no beta effects whatsoever, so it's all strictly alpha. You're not going to have any heart rate effects. You're not going to have any increased myocardial oxygen consumption whatsoever. The problem with neosinephrine and the problem with levofed as well is once you start increasing the systolic and diastolic blood pressure and increasing those doses, it actually decreases blood flow to those vital organs, your skin, your muscles, and things like that. So you have to be very careful. This patient right here is already in multiple organ dysfunction. And so if you have a patient that's extremely hypoxic, and one way to identify that is to be looking at your different formulas, your FIC formula, and looking at and trending in SVO2. And you can do that based on that SWAN. That SWAN, based on that mixed venous blood, you can trend that SVO2 and identify, is this patient becoming more and more hypoxic tissue-wise? So we have to remember neosinephrine is a great medication, but it is going to decrease blood flow to those organs, and so you have to really be very careful and aggressive with your oxygenation therapy. The way we mix that, we do standardly normally like 50 milligrams and 250. Again, your dosing range is going to be 40 to 100 mics per minute. You do a loading dose, and then we can again titrate that up. The other medication that we talked about is going to be your Levofed, and remember, your Levofed medication is norepinephrine. Norepinephrine works very, very similar, but it does have some beta-1 runoff. Primarily, though, that beta-1 is going to be inotropic, so it's going to help with some contractility. So oftentimes, I've flown the last 12 years, and you still see smaller facilities where you walk in, they may have dopamine on at 20 mics per minute. We know that once we get above 10 mics, dopamine kind of has that opposite effect, and you're going to have so much heart rate effect, you're not going to have diastolic clearing, diastolic filling. Your heart's going so fast that you're causing poor cardiac output, and your blood pressure is going to remain low. So norepinephrine is a great medication to add where you're going to get some squeeze, but you also it's potent alpha respectively. Again, same type of thought process. It's going to start decreasing blood flow to those vital organs, the skin, the muscles, and things like that. So we have to be cognizant of that and really optimize oxygenation. The easiest, quickest way to mix is 4 milligrams and 250 mils. That's how I always do it. And then your dosing range is 2 to 12 mics per minute. Okay, so with this patient, a lot of times with a patient in cardiogenic shock, I said that the patient's going to have a CVP that's high, their PA pressures are going to be high, their wedge is going to be high, their cardiac output is going to be low, but their SVR is going to be through the roof. Their SVR is going to be high. The body's going to try to compensate and try to squeeze to optimize cardiac output. Well, that actually causes a problem because it just causes this big revolving circle. And so oftentimes, and one medication that this patient may have benefited from because he had a blood pressure to warrant it is maybe the addition of dobutamine. Dobutamine is a medication where you could give where it's going to increase contractility, but the initial effects of dobutamine are going to relax that heart. By relaxing that heart, it reduces SVR. By reducing SVR, it allows for better diastolic clearing, better diastolic filling, and then you have that inotropy from the medication, the properties of the medication that helps with the squeeze. So in this patient, because the blood pressure was initially 100 over 40, he would have benefited. Now, his MAP was 61, so we have to look at that. We want a MAP of about 65 to get good perfusion to our kidneys, to our brain. We already have a patient that's already in chronic renal failure. So, this patient needs improvement. They need something, and their diastolic pressure, you can see, is being a diastolic pressure of 40 is very, very low. So just an idea of a medication that you could add in this situation that may improve. Obviously, we have the balloon pump in place. The balloon pump, the whole purpose, again, is to optimize diastolic perfusion, coronary artery perfusion, so that's good. So this flight crew continued with the patient management. They started noticing as they landed at the receiving facility, they had a pretty uneventful flight, made a few little vent changes, increased the rate. The balloon pump managed to remain unchanged. They continued with the one-to-one timing. They remained with the EKG trigger. The internal pacer remained the same, but they started noticing their blood pressures on the balloon pump as well as their blood pressures, arterial blood pressures, started dropping. So right before they land, their blood pressure now is 87 over 30. They have a MAP of now 49. Their heart rate is still at 80 because it's paced. Heart rate's the same, and their O2 stat is down to 93. All right, so they land. They have to be transferred to an ambulance to be taken to another facility because there's no helipad there. And as they pull up to the ER doors, their patient goes into cardiac arrest. So they immediately start CPR. So this is an important thing to remember with a balloon pump. The balloon pump is actually going to help you in this situation. even though that balloon pump is huge and cumbersome and you have all this equipment you're managing, you've got the vent, you've got the balloon pump, you know, and a lot of these balloon pumps are very, very heavy. You're going to have a hard time managing all this. So I believe they went out, they got extra help from the ER, they came in. But the first thing you want to do in this situation, we talked about your primary trigger is your EKG. In this situation, because now your EKG, you have no pulse, you're at cardiac arrest, you need to switch to an arterial trigger. So now your balloon pump is going to be timing on the ART line. The balloon pump is going to time on the ART line, and if you do good quality CPR, you're going to get a continued pressure where you're going to get an arterial waveform. All right, that's what this flight crew did. They switched to a ART line pressure trigger. They started CPR. They got extra help. They were able to offload the patient, but despite all their efforts and their good care, this patient did succumb from the disease process in the ED, and they called the code about 30 minutes later. So, you know, again, this flight crew had a lot of things going on. They had the vent, they had the balloon pump, they had an internal pacer, they had two pressors to deal with, and they had a patient that was very, very sick. And I think they managed this patient very, very well, considering. I mean, I think, you know, everything considered, they did an excellent job. So I hope everybody learned something from this case study. Again, we're going to go specifically into advanced hemodynamics. We're going to do one on balloon pump therapy, and we're going to do one on specifically LVADs in the next month, month and a half. But that's all I have for this presentation. If you have any questions, comments, please email me at eric@flightbridgeed.com. Remember, we have our CFR and FPC book on sale on our website. We've had great reviews. We've got very, very high pass rates in the mid-90s. And look for review classes. We've got review classes in San Bernardino, California. We've got a review class in Oregon again. We've got two in Colorado. We've got one in Kentucky in a couple weeks. So look at the website, see if one of those fits your schedule. And we appreciate everything everybody's done for us, for the following, for allowing us to invest in your education. And we'll talk to you soon. We want to thank you for following Flight Bridge Ed.